Hi, Patrick Cox here with a world in words from your grandmother. So today, the words your grandmother passed on, for better or worse. There's this one, Davka.
I don't want you to do it, and you Davka do it to me.
And the tongue twisters of a Chinese grandmother.
Dong dok dok, sai dok dok, dok dao bak gok, mai ling gok, ling gok hok, dui mun chen gok lok.
Just wait till you hear her curses.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
Absolute, the biggest load of chicken droppings I've heard in a long time, Jeremy, I have to say.
The World in Words podcast and the World Radio program are co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH here in Boston. The World, the big show, is on more than 280 public radio stations around the United States. You can listen online at theworld.org. Also, go there to check out all of our other podcasts. I post notes on this pod with links, pics, everything like that, at theworld.org/language. And at patrickcox.wordpress.com. There's the Facebook World in Words group page, and I'm also on Twitter. My handle is P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X, Patrick Cox. So it's not, to my knowledge, anything like Day of the Grandmother or Week of the Grandmother. Maybe it is in some part of the world. But it's just that grandmother talk is something I've been thinking about for a while. Sadly, I can't remember things that either of my grandmothers said to me, though judging by what other relatives have told me, it sounded as though each of those two women had some pretty salty things to say. Often more than grandfathers, it seems, too. They play an active role in grandchild rearing, and certainly in communicating, you know, an old world, an old linguistic world. And that old world is often a different country and a different language. Case in point, is the grandmother of the big show's Marco Werman.
My grandmother, who's Dutch, was Dutch. She died a few years ago. When I was a kid, maybe about five, six, seven, I started hearing this phrase, and I would hear it when my mother, who was also born Dutch, she and her mother would converse, and this phrase, Godverdomme, would always come up. And I could tell by the look on their face that it wasn't a good thing. Well, I later found out that it was the equivalent of, well, GD, just darn it, like the worst kind of darn it you could ever like express. And I began saying it. And then my mom told me at one point, look, you really shouldn't say that in front of your grandmother because it's really pretty bad. I later found out that, you know, wasn't so bad for me to say it in front of my grandmother. There were lots of other phrases that she actually taught me that were far worse. But so, you know, thank you so much for those dirty words in Dutch, Grandma Oma.
The big show's Marco Werman, learning what his mother wouldn't teach him. And that seems to be a theme of words our grandmothers teach us. Coming up, the magnificent fictional and non-fictional world of Chinese-American writer Marilyn Chin and her grandmother. First, we're going to eat sideways with Nina Pozuki and her grandmother. Eating sideways, of course, is the segment in the pod where we feature a foreign expression that doesn't readily translate into English. This week, that expression is Davka. I'll leave it at that. Here's Nina.
Davka is a Yiddish word that my 83-year-old Polish grandmother has exclaimed at me my entire life. Roughly translated, it means to do something out of spite. My grandmother defines the word as...
Just because. Because I don't want you to do it, and you Davka do it to me. That's the explanation of the word Davka.
Now, I've always thought that Davka was a Yiddish word, but according to Michael Wex, a native Yiddish speaker and author of two books about Yiddish, Born to Kvetch and Jesse New, Davka is neither a Yiddish word nor a Hebrew word.
It's originally actually it's Aramaic, technically. So really it went from Aramaic to Hebrew to Yiddish. So I'm sure if you ask the average Israeli today, they'd just tell you, oh, it's a Hebrew word.
There are many words that have crossed into Yiddish from Hebrew, from Aramaic. Words like Shabbos, which is the word for Shabbat or the Sabbath, and punim, which is Yiddish for face. The basic meaning and use of the Hebrew word davka, according to Wex, doesn't differ much from its Yiddish iteration.
You could say in Yiddish, it's got to be davka azoy, this way and not any other way. Mm. But usually that's used in a sort of ironic questioning way. If somebody says, if you walk through that puddle, that's not just a puddle, but that's an acid rain puddle, and your feet will burn off if you walk through it, you say, well, I'm going to Dafka walk through it. That means I'm walking through it anyway, despite any warnings that you might have given me, despite what your opinion might be.
In some ways, this word seems like the epitome of Yiddish.
It's the kind of mindset that you will find with an unpopular and embattled minority.
It's that stubbornness.
Yeah, which you need, you know, to be the kind of minority that Jews are, where you could get out of it. You know, you could convert. That kind of screw you attitude has kept the Jewish people going. The language is a reflection of the way the people who spoke it lived. I mean, I guess any language is, but Yiddish more so, because, you know, many of the people, if not most of the people who spoke Yiddish, were able to speak something else. So why did they need a language of their own? And, you know, there are a number of sociolinguistic reasons for something like this, but one of the things is Yiddish really reflected what they couldn't say to people from outside the Jewish community, you know, thoughts and feelings that were just not acceptable.
So Dafka, they'll speak in their own tongue.
There's a perfect use of it.
Well, that's Dafka, an ancient expression which encapsulates centuries of oppression and the mindset of an entire people. Okay. This fails to impress my grandmother, who instead reminds me of when I was 5 years old and decided to jump into a puddle. Mind you, there was no acid rain involved. However, she did warn me.
Don't go with your shoes in the puddle, but just because I said it, Dafka, you did it.
Nina Porzuki's grandmother, ending Nina's report. And this, by the way, has been a first on the pod. Nina is a listener, just like you. She contacted me a few weeks ago with the idea that she'd like to do this Eating Sideways segment on her grandmother. And, well, it turned out great. So big thanks to you, Nina. And anybody else who wants to do something similar, just let me know. Facebook is probably the easiest way to find me, or send me an email. The address is language@pri.org. Now to poet and novelist Marilyn Chin. She has quite a grandmother too. If you didn't hear last week's pod, number 73, check it out. There's a bit at the end of the episode with Marilyn waxing lyrical about the expression chop suey. It's hilarious. Anyways, Marilyn Chin is the author of 3 volumes of poetry. We'll hear one of her poems later on. First, I want to play an excerpt from her new novel. It's actually her first novel, and it's called Revenge of the Mooncake Vixen. It's a little difficult to describe because it's so many things all at once. It's a coming-of-age novel. It's a classic American immigrant story. And it's also a fable, or a series of fables, quite surreal ones at that. That's one of the nice things about Revenge of the Mooncake Vixen. It keeps you on your toes. So, you know, in one chapter, the characters are playing out a fairly naturalistic scene. Many of those revolve around a family-run Chinese restaurant in the United States, and some of these are side-splittingly funny. Then, in the next chapter, a character may suddenly morph into a creature from Chinese mythology, a sea monster or something like that. Here's one of the more naturalistic episodes. It's a dialogue between a Mrs. Jones, who's British, and a Mrs. Wong, who's Chinese. It takes place in British-run Hong Kong. Mrs. Jones lives there. Her son is engaged to one of Mrs. Wong's 2 twin daughters. These daughters are the main characters of the book. And reading the excerpt is The Big Show's Tracy Tong.
You speak English very well, Mrs. Wong. I am most impressed. Thank you for your kindness, Mrs. Jones. But no, actually, my English is quite wretched. No, I'm not patronizing you at all, Mrs. Wong. Really, you speak English very well, especially for a foreigner. Oh, I suppose that's not the way to put it. We are all foreigners in this god-awful colonial outpost. Nobody is indigenous here, are we? No offense taken, Mrs. Jones. My people came from Guangzhou after the communist takeover in 49. We're all strangers here. No, my English is quite substandard. I learned it in the orphanage in Hong Kong from an Italian nun named Sister Teresa. She had a thick Sicilian accent, but purported that she spoke the king's English and not the queen's. So my English is quite wretched, really, but I guess it's tolerable for a Chinese housewife in Hong Kong. Most of my people refuse to even bother. No, really, you mustn't dismiss yourself that way. Haven't you read The Second Sex? We women must stick together. I heard from Mei Ling that you were widowed very young. You raised such fine daughters all by yourself. You are truly an accomplished woman. Let's put all false modesty aside, shall we? After all, my Douglas wants to marry your Mei Ling. We're almost related already. Our blood's almost mingled. Yes, I read The Second Sex in a very bad translation from French into Italian, finally translated into vulgar Chinese by yet another unsavory Italian nun named Fenollosa. Well, my dear, you deserve an A+ for your fine, unsavory Italian English. Why, my husband and I have been living in Hong Kong for 30 years, and we don't know a word of Chinese. We've become so used to impeccable translators hired by his firm to cater to us. I dare say that I can't even go to the corner store to get milk. I have to point and make comical gestures in shape of a cow to make myself understood. The storekeeper stared at me humorlessly and must have thought, what a total moron this woman is.
Now, this battle of self-deprecating one-upmanship between Mrs. Jones and Mrs. Wong heats up considerably. I'll let Marilyn Chin explain what's going on.
Mrs. Jones tries to make peace or make a friendship with Mrs. Wong, but Mrs. Wong, in sort of oppositional fashion, starts jabbing at Mrs. Jones and tires her out, and she wins the battle in the end. In the end is a nasty pun. She says, "You know what they say in the colonies? It's not so much the heat as it is the humility."
Right, and that's one of many, many word plays. I mean, the book is absolutely full of them. And there's also, I get the sense that each of them, although they're using, quote, the same language, they really are speaking right across each other.
That's right. And she's, Mrs. Wong, you know, she uses negative affirmations. There's a whole idea about Chinese humility. You know, if you have two Chinese mothers together, they will say all kinds of negative, terrible things about their children. It's a war of words. As a war of humility. It's false humility, of course, but somebody ultimately wins in the end.
Right, right. And it's very interesting to have the sort of the use of the English language in this. This is not the native tongue of Mrs. Wong, and presumably many original thoughts will go unexpressed in such a borrowed language, and yet it's the only way that she has of communicating with the colonialist.
That's right. And she out-silver tongues the colonialist, actually. Ultimately, she will give Mei Ling's hand to Mrs. Jones. But you can tell that in this relationship, she is not going to give an inch to this family.
You yourself were born in Hong Kong, right? And then you moved to the United States when you were seven to Portland, Oregon.
Right.
So you grew up speaking Cantonese first and then English?
That's right. My first language was actually Toi San Hua. It is a sub-dialect, Toi San dialect of Cantonese, which is the Hong Kong dialect. So there are many languages and many dialects spoken in our family, in one family, so that the child had to, you know, switch languages and switch dialects depending on whom she is having a conversation with. So when I'm talking to my grandmother, I speak in her dialect. And when I was in school, I would speak in Cantonese. And in those days, Mandarin was non-existent. I was born in colonial Hong Kong. And the nuns tried to teach us English, but I was too young to really absorb English. So I learned English when I got to the U.S.
So you got to the U.S. and you were speaking Toi San Hua with your grandmother and English outside of that. What were you speaking to your siblings?
We spoke in English. Now, it's very interesting about my siblings because I'm the oldest, so I still have the language now, most of it. But my brother, for instance, the youngest one, he could barely speak, you know, a few words, and he would grunt. You know, my mother would ask, "Are you hungry?" He would say, You know, he couldn't, for some reason, formulate the words to make entire sentences. That's the process of assimilation. The vector only goes one direction. It's very difficult to rediscover it. You have to take language classes and go to the homeland, right?
Absolutely. And it's not as if it's Mandarin, which is much easier to come across. And
that's right. And I just came back from Beijing, so I sort of patch up various dialects and languages and try to get through the day. After a while, though, I was able to figure things out. And it's really wonderful to have a second language or a third language, whatever. Americans, I think, are monolingual, which is too bad. This global world, we need to know more than one language. We need to be trilingual, quadrilingual, or something.
How has that affected your poetry and your writing, just being able to speak? I mean, you say that you can't describe yourself as bilingual, but certainly understanding a huge amount of another language. Has that affected some of the choices that you've made when writing?
I worked hard at retaining my Chinese, so I went back to Taiwan and Hong Kong, and my undergraduate degree was in classical Chinese literature. I knew that as a poet, I wanted to have the richness of two literary histories. And so I worked very hard at it. It's about making those images and puns and having two worlds collide on the page.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of natural for drama and confrontation, among many other things, if you've got both of those going.
That's right. It's about the oppositional forces more than a melodious force. You know, it's about two worlds rubbing against each other, sometimes in a violent, wild way, and sometimes in a melodic way. I like those confrontations. I like the hardcore, the edges. I like to test the edges, the sublime and the ridiculous, the sacred and the profane.
And there's plenty of that, sacred, profane, everything in The Revenge of the Mooncake Vixen, which makes turning the page, I mean, you just don't quite know what's going to happen next. In the book, the name of the restaurant where many of the scenes are set and where the twins grow up is called Double Happiness.
That's right.
And it's very funny because, firstly, it's not the happiest place in the world. And the way in which you describe it is really a way station for these particular daughters of immigrants. They can only really achieve happiness, double or otherwise, if they leave and go to Harvard and become doctors or lawyers.
That's right. It's a weighing Yeah. It's the immigrant generation that come here and start these little businesses, and they don't want their descendants to stay in this business. They want their kids and grandkids to go to Harvard, as Grandma Wong says, to work in that tall glass building in the sky.
Yeah, and I got all of this stuff from the expression double happiness. Maybe I was reading too much into it, but double happiness is first, as I said before, ironic because there's very little happiness. Secondly, there's this sort of doubleness, which is a nod to the fact that the main characters are twins. There's two of
them. That's right.
And also, the double happiness is, for me, felt like it was part of the double cultural life
That's immigrants, right.
And children of immigrants lead. Mm-hmm. So of this double stuff was everywhere.
They refer to the twins and they refer to double consciousness as a phrase coined by W.E.B. Du Bois about being a person of color in America, that you have an identity at home and then you have another identity outside of the home and you have to negotiate both worlds. So it's double terror and double happiness, right?
Your main twins in this, Mooney and Mei Ling, they're both fantastic characters, and there seems to be sort of different sides of a similar coin. But, you know, as you catch them in their teenage years, they both hate their restaurant jobs, and Mei Ling especially is just completely uninterested in fulfilling the basic tasks involved, and all she wants to do is be young and American, get high, get laid, which she does an awful lot. And then also you have the grandmother character who, like her granddaughter, she has this kind of archetypal side to her, domineering matriarch.
That's right.
And then she also sort of plays a goddess-like figure in some of the more surreal scenes.
That's right. She had the eight-armed bodhisattva, the eight-armed
combination of
Kali, the goddess of destruction, and then the nurturing goddess, the goddess of mercy. So she's really terrifying, yes.
Totally terrifying. And then there's a bit toward the end of the novel where the adult Mooney tries to banish the ghost of her grandmother.
That's right.
And
that's
she
right.
she just keeps hearing her grandmother in her head. She hears her grandmother's archaic dialect. Her, what was it? Toisanhua?
Toisanhua. Yeah, you're very good. You're Chinese, really. It's wonderful. Your intonations are great.
Her archaic Toisanhua dialect. And she describes that dialect as hard on the ears, as these are your words, cacophonic, accusatory, downright malicious and abusive. And reading that, it sounded to me as though the language and the person being described have just merged into the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll give you an example. She would used to say, "Li nui, li nui." And that, the THL, whatever.
What does that mean?
It means it's a curse. It's like dead girl, dead girl. And when you hear that, it's terrifying. It is a curse that is said a lot in peasant society, in peasant families. And then I stopped her once and I said, "You must stop saying that, because it is a terrible curse to talk about death, to say death to your grandchildren." She says, "Oh, well, that's an expression we use all the time. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean anything." But
oh, that's great. So wait a minute. You're now talking about your own grandmother, not
my own grandmother. My own grandmother.
Who's
yes.
clearly quite a model for the grandmother in the book.
Absolutely. She was a cleaver-wielding grandmother. She used to sit on the milk box with the cleaver, you know, and she used to chase away our boyfriends. And then we would try to find another hiding place 2 blocks away. And she would find that hiding place and she'd run screaming, yelling with her cleaver. She was mad. But
was she as unsuccessful as the grandmother in the novel in protecting the maidenhead of her granddaughter?
That's right. She was very unsuccessful. Yeah, we were wild girls. We lost our virginities very young. We smoked pot. I used to hitchhike up to Vancouver to rock festivals. She couldn't keep the lid on our maidenheads. That's, you know, that's for sure. She tried very hard. And so those expressions, I guess our mothers or our parents' voices will forever be embedded into our brains, right? But my grandmother, her voice, she haunts me in my dreams. Yeah, you know, she'd come in and into my dreams and curse me for this and that. It's just, I guess it must be guilt or it must be guilt. But she had a wild tongue.
Can you give me a couple other examples of her Toisanhua?
Oh, some things I can't even say because, oh, they were so terrible. But she would say, "Ni hui nai ya, yu hui la? Yu hui nai ya? Where are you going? You're going again?" And the tone of the you know, the up and the sing-songy, and that would sort of funnel into my ear. She would also, she knew a lot of tongue twisters, and there's one that goes like this: "Dong dok dok sai dok 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 dao bak got mai ling got hok dui mun chong got lo." And so there's all these.
Wow, what does that mean?
It's like, oh, you sat, you run to the east, you run to the west, you run to Mongkok, which is a place in Hong Kong, and you buy ling got, which is a kind of nut, and then it's hard to translate, but it's rhyme. You know, it's fast delivery, it's tongue twisting. It's really wonderful. There are a lot of these tongue twisters that I remember, and some of them I don't even know what they mean. So very young, I got into puns and singing and rhyming. So that's why I became a poet, because her voice and the voices of those first 7 years of my life were prominent in my brain. Somehow they entered the soul in a deep way that really transformed into poetry.
Marilyn Chin. I asked Marilyn to read one of her poems. Here it is. It's called "To Pursue the Limitless," from a collection called Rhapsody in Plain Yellow.
To pursue the limitless with a hare-brained paramour. To chase a dull husband with a sharp knife. To speak to Rose about her thorny sisters. Lock the door behind you. The restaurant is on fire. You are named after flour and precious metal. You are touched by mercury. Your birth name is dawning. Your milk name is twilight. Your betrothed name is dusk. To speak in dainty aphorisms, to dither in monosyllables, binomes copulating in midair. To teach English as a second, third, fourth language. You were faithful to the original. You were married to the Chinese paradox. Mei yan bu xin, xin yan bu mei. Beautiful words are not truthful. The truth is not beautiful. You have translated bitter as melon, fruit as willful absence. You were mum as an egg. He was brutal as an embryo. Blood soup will congeal in the refrigerator. You are both naturalized citizens. You have the right to a little ecstasy. To err is human. To wu is woman. Mai ma, berry mother. Mai ma, sold hemp. Mai ma, bought horse. No, not the tones, but the tomes. You said, my name is Zhuang Mei, sturdy beauty. But he thought you said, Shuang Mei, frosty plum. He brandished his arc of black hair like a coxcomb. He said, meet me at the airport travelator. His back door was lovelier than his front door. A smear of bile on your dress proved his existence. I don't think I can tell you what it all means, but...
Nor do I try to understand everything in it, although I repeatedly get the sense that we're trapped by language, we're imprisoned by the images of languages like a bitter melon, but also you just play off of sounds, sounds in Chinese that kind of reflect back on a completely different meaning in English.
That's right.
And you play around with the tones as well, which, of course, is a horrible curse for anybody trying to learn Chinese.
And the possible gaffes that one could make, the difference between buried mother and bought horse is a big difference and is a very interesting, it could be a very interesting mistake, or the paradox of Mei yan bu xin, xin yan bu mei. It's really a beautiful couplet, and beautiful words are not truthful. The truth is not beautiful. One can look at this this couplet for a long time. It is such a perfect, beautiful couplet. And to err, the err means two.
As in the numeral.
Mandarin,
yeah.
And to wu is woman, and wu is five in Mandarin. So I was playing around with tones and onomatopoeia and puns and so forth. And I think, yeah, I had a lot of fun doing this.
And I had a lot of fun talking with Marilyn Chin. Hope you had fun listening to it. And that's it for this week. See you on Facebook, Twitter, wherever you can find me. More next week.